This is David Cole. Thank you very much for joining us, and welcome to our Q2 results conference call. I'm here today with Michel Lyers, our Group CEO, and Matt Webber, our Group Chief Underwriting Officer. Our Chief Actuary, Mike Eaves, is also joining us today. As you will have seen, we published a short video this morning on our P&C reserve methodology, as well as the usual information we publish around this time regarding our loss triangles. Let me just start with a brief overview of the results we published this morning. You have seen Q2 2015 group net income was $820 million, bringing us to a total net income for the first half of $2.3 billion, which is up by 11% versus the comparable 2014 period. Both the Q2 ROE of 9.5% as well as the half-year ROE of 13.5%, we believe, are continuing proof of the group's strong financial performance. You'll have seen all business units made a profitable contribution to the solid Q2 results. P&C Re reported a good underwriting result and successful July renewals with attractive price quality. Life & Health Re's performance remained on track with an ROE of 14%. Corporate Solutions delivered profitable results and remained focused on the quality of its portfolio. Admin Re generated gross cash in line with expectations. I have no doubt all of you will have also noticed that all three business units have now paid dividends up to the group during the first half of the year. You'll recall Corporate Solutions paid $200 million dividend up to the group in Q1, and during Q2, Reinsurance paid $3 billion and Admin Re just over $400 million. With that, I'll hand over to our Head of Investor Relations, Philippe Brahin, who will introduce the Q&A session.
Thank you, David, and good day also to all of you from my side. Just before we turn to the Q&A, I would like to remind you to please restrict yourself to two questions each, and please re-register for follow-up questions. With that, operator, could we please take the first question?
We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on the touch-tone telephone. The first question comes from Inyong Kang from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Good morning. This is Inyong Kang from Goldman. Two questions from me. Firstly, on your reiteration of your 97% combined ratio guidance. Adjusting for runoff Nat Cats and man-made loss variation in the first half, I think it gets an underlying combined ratio of 99.6%. It would have to be a substantial improvement in the second half to get to the 97% for the full year. Just wondering what gives you the confidence. Is it just seasonally lower commissions, trends you see in the business that you wrote this year, or something else going on there? Secondly, on the buyback. As far as I can see, the $1 billion share buyback for this year has not yet started. Could you share any kind of thoughts around your thinking around the timing, and yeah, the reason why it hasn't started yet? Thank you.
Okay. I'll ask Matt Webber to address the first question, and then I'll come back around regarding the buyback. Matt, is that all right?
Okay. The 97% combined ratio guidance relates to Reinsurance only. The guidance for Corporate Solutions is 98%. The reason why we are confident is the following. If we start with the 103 adjusted combined ratio, this quarter, we had an higher amount of large man-made losses. They amount to approximately 2 percentage points, 1.6 percentage points to be exact. In addition to that, you know we adjust our premium on a quarterly basis based on Nat Cat seasonality, and the second quarter is a quarter with a low Nat Cat expected loss. We decreased the earned premium relative to if we just took a linear approach. This leads to a situation where the cost ratio relative to the decreased premium is higher. For instance, we also have more earned proportional business than we do have earned non-proportional business, because most of the Nat Cat business is written on a non-proportional basis. This amounts to approximately 3%, 2.8 percentage points to be exact. In addition to that, we have a one-off unallocated loss adjustment expense charge of 0.6%. So if we take this all into account, we get to 98% instead of 97% as per our guidance. And now you need to take into account two things. If you look historically at our combined ratio pattern, you notice that during the second quarter or in the second quarter, we always are a little bit higher with our P&C combined ratio compared to what we then ended up at year end. And secondly, 1% relative to approximately $3.5 billion is $35 million. That's a relatively small number compared to the limits we put out on individual risk. So what I'm trying to say, in addition, with all the corrections we are doing, we will always have a remaining natural variability from one quarter to the other quarter. And that's the reason why we believe it would be completely unnecessary and actually wrong to adjust our combined ratio guidance. So we continue to be comfortable with the 97% on the reinsurance side and see no need to adjust the guidance.
Okay, thank you, Matt, for, I think, a very detailed, excellent response. I hope that satisfied, no doubt, broader groups of questions. We'll get around that, but we'll see later on. Coming back to the second question on the buyback. So as I think all of you know, we received approval from our shareholders' meeting this past April for a up to 1 billion franc buyback to be concluded in advance of the shareholders' meeting in 2016. We've communicated a little bit earlier this year that in terms of actually launching the program, we would be unlikely to do that prior to the end of Q3. Basically, we want to see how loss and profits develop over the course of the year. It would be a little bit premature, perhaps, before the windstorm season in North America. Obviously, we also look to see what opportunities we have to invest it, along with our strategy at attractive returns. So I would just indicate to you not to expect most likely not to expect any further communication around that prior to the end of Q3.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Next question comes from Kamran Hossain, RBC. Please go ahead.
Hi. Austin, I've got two questions. First one, and I think it would be great for it's not on the underlying loss ratio, it's just on admin re. So seeing you've taken $400 million out of the business and upstreamed it to the group, and I know your target over the 2-year period was $600 million. Can I just ask, is there any scope to further reduce that amount of capital in that business? And I guess kind of some colour on how Solvency II discussions or kind of what's happened with the model so far would be useful there. The second question is just on corporate solutions. It sounds like you're going to hit the lower end of your 4 to 5 billion premium volume for this year. Are we looking at the end of the growth phase for corporate solutions? And if so, understand there's about 4 percentage points of the combined ratio at Corso linked to kind of the growth phase. So how soon might we see that kind of backing out? Thanks.
I have to say, the last part of the question I wasn't able to understand. So if you wouldn't mind, when you first started talking about corporate solutions, could you just repeat that?
Yeah, of course. It's so understand there's about 4 percentage points in the combined ratio at corporate solutions that are kind of baked in for kind of growth initiatives. So I was just wondering how quickly that we might see that reverse out of the Corso combined ratio.
Okay, thanks. I think I understand now. You're referring specifically to the expense levels, I believe. So let me first start with Admin Re, and then we'll wrap back around to Corporate Solutions. So, yes, we are very pleased to have received the $400 million dividend during Q2. We had previously communicated that over the period 2015-2016, we would expect something in the order of magnitude of $600 million. So clearly we're well on our way to that. little bit too early to give any updated guidance in terms of the remainder of the period 2015-2016, but certainly you can expect us to do so toward the end of the year. We do make continued good progress in terms of preparation for Solvency II. You'll have seen that we were doing some rebalancing, readjustment of our asset portfolio in the first half associated with the Solvency II. We've rounded that off at this point in time. I guess as most other insurance groups in the UK, we have very engaged, very intense discussions with the PRA, but we remain comfortable regarding where we're going to land those discussions. So I guess in terms of capital extraction and our capital deployment, the nature of that business is, of course, is that we do expect it to throw off capital. The possibility of us injecting capital, I think, should also not be neglected by analysts or investors. The nature of that business is that we seek to acquire profitable new blocks of business. So as and when we would be able to secure such a block, we would also be willing to invest capital back into that business. Coming to your comment about the word baked in that you use. So indeed, we do recognize a higher expense level now, which shows through on the combined ratio that we report for Corporate Solutions. That's associated with the growth of both footprint as well as product capabilities. That's an ongoing initiative. It's not something that will end this year, for instance. It could well be another couple of years. But we certainly would expect over a period of time, and reflecting the business mix of Corso, that those expense levels would come back down to levels more comparable vis-a-vis its appropriate peers.
Thanks very much. Very clear.
Yeah.
Next question comes from Thomas Seidel, Bernstein. Please go ahead, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Two questions. One on the pricing. I think you commented you had a successful renewal, and you said that the price strength of the book is now 105. Just a clarification here. So does this mean, because on a year-on-year basis, it's down 3%, but it's stable versus January, does this mean that the price softening is equal to what we saw at January 1, or does it mean you were able to renew the book at July 1, basically at flat rates? That's my first question. Second question regarding your priorities for the group. 2015, the update you gave on slide 17, we note that basically you have taken away the previous point saying you want to grow regular dividend, and you put up an emphasis on allocating capital to risk pools with attractive, revenue and income stream. So I wonder what we should read into that. Any comments would be very helpful on that. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Thomas. So let me first hand over to Matt.
Okay. So the 105%, what it first means is you're probably aware of the fact that the January renewed treaty business written out of reinsurance amounts to approximately two-thirds of the total renewable business. So two-thirds of the premium volume renews January 1, and the remaining one-third renews during the other quarters. And this means the year-to-date price quality or rate adequacy, if you will, is heavily determined by the January 1 business, because it just has a huge amount of weight. Or in other words, in order to deviate from the 105% on a year-to-date basis, the July business would have to be significantly different from 105% in order to really have an impact. So that's probably the more formalistic, quantitative, mathematical answer. If I try to answer your question qualitatively, I would say one of your options is probably reasonably close to the truth. The rate decreases we have seen at the July renewals have approximately the same order of magnitude as the rate decreases we have seen during the January renewals. And now you can say, wait, this doesn't sound right to me, because everybody is saying rate decreases have started to tone down a little bit. Is this not true for Swiss Re? And the answer is it's absolutely also true for Swiss Re. And the way how to make sense of this is the following. In the January 1 renewal, you have significantly less Nat Cat business and significantly more man-made business that has experienced historically less rate erosion than the Nat Cat business. And during the July renewals, we have a significantly bigger proportion of Nat Cat business. So if I say qualitatively the rate decreases of July and January business are about the same, have the same order of magnitude, this means the Nat Cat business renewed during the July renewal, which historically experienced significantly bigger decreases, these decreases have toned down to the level of the rate decreases we have seen on other business. And that's the way how the whole thing fits together. I hope this answers your question also qualitatively to your satisfaction.
Thank you.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
So, Michelle? Thomas, thank you for your question. It will give me the opportunity to eliminate any kind of potential confusion. We didn't change anything in the philosophy of dividend. You remember, first priority is the classical dividend for which we definitely want to keep it at its level or grow it at the speed at which we grow the business. The second one are opportunities existing to invest the capital at our appetite, the one that we choose, the one that Mother Nature decide. And the third one, which has been for the last 3 years this extra dividend, and which maybe in the future the share buyback program is giving back money to the shareholders in case definitively there is no other way to invest this money according to our appetite. No change in that respect, and thank you for the question allowing me to underline that.
All right. Thank you.
Next question comes from Michael Huttner, JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Two questions. One, the very strong growth of 31% at the renewal. Maybe I'm a bit soft, but if I grow this much in a market which I don't think is growing much, then I must be doing something to shift the business, some kind of incentive, or I don't know. Maybe you can give a little bit of background. It's a very nice number, but it's so big. And then the other question, and this is something where, do you remember, Mr. Lees, at a lunch a while back, you kind of said, oh, maybe in the future you will say how wonderful our life business is and how difficult the non-life is. Would you be tempted, given the life is actually delivering over your target ROE, to raise the target ROE? I think it's 10 to 12. You reported, I'm not sure whether it's 14 or 16. That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Answering the first question, the growth is, on a year-to-date basis, all of the growth can be explained by large and tailored transactions. If I call all the business that is not large and tailored, if I call that business transactional, for a moment. If we just look at the volume from transactional business, which is subject to the market-wide demand-supply-induced price pressure and market softening, then actually our volume has decreased. However, we significantly overcompensated for this by writing additional large transactions and tailored transactions, which are significantly less exposed to these demand-supply market-driven market softening. And that's the reason why, on the one side, we fully understand the concern behind your question, but on the other side, we are also very confident answering this question and actually quite proud about this exceptional growth coming from exceptional business.
Thank you.
Michael, thank you for the question on life. Definitely, you know, the life return 10 to 12 was courageously put on the table by Christian Mumenthaler and Alison Martin, I should say Alison Martin and Christian Mumenthaler, mid-2013, to just explain what we wanted to achieve in 2015 after the work done in the 18 months between mid-2013 and end 2014. I think it was courageous. We are in this range. I appreciate massively your trust in the life business to ask me just after two quarters if it's not time to move that. I would say not yet, if I may answer.
Excellent. Thank you.
Next question comes from Anasuya Ewer, Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi. My first question was on the investment side. You said your realized gains went down because that's with the increasing interest rates, but I understand that the reinvestment yield remains unchanged at 1.6% versus quarter one. I'm just wondering why that is and why it's not gone up. And the second question was just on the man-made losses. I wonder if you could help me understand a bit more about whether this is concentrated in a handful of claims or if it's widespread and whether the exposure could be more in the following quarters. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. So let me take the first one and I'll hand over to Matt for the second. So there are two aspects, I think, when you look at the results on the investment side. The first, you ask about the unrealized gains and the reduction. That, of course, is looking at the entire balance sheet and just bringing it to the current market value based on the macroeconomic, primarily interest rate moves, but also credit spread moves. But the clear major driver here is interest rates moves. So that's just looking at the entire balance sheet, whereas the reinvestment level looks at actual transactions that we did during the course of the quarter. The reason that that number is as it is because we used a good bit of our cash we used cash in the course of the quarter for two specific reasons. We obviously paid out $2.6 billion of dividends during the quarter, and we invested about the same level, a little bit less, about $2 billion or so, into relatively shorter duration government bonds, and I think that probably influences the reported reinvestment yield. Matt, you want to?
Okay. With respect to the man-made losses, it's probably easiest if I just talk about the losses we have seen and experienced on the corporate solution side. And the reason why I pick corporate solution is for this business unit, the ratio between large man-made losses and earned premium is significantly bigger than this is the case for the reinsurance side. As a result of which, of course, also the quarterly volatility coming from that angle is significantly bigger depending on whether we are seeing a little bit more or a little bit less of these large man-made losses. To give you a little bit of feeling, on the corporate solution side, we expected large man-made losses of the order of $73 million. And what we experienced is 114. It's actually in percent of what we expected, not a huge difference. It's less than 50, or it's approximately 50% more, so that's a natural volatility. But it impacts the combined ratio by almost 5 points. So that's something to keep in mind. And these losses which we experienced during this quarter are spread all over the world, actually including the air and space. They include a space loss, then the famous Mexico oil platform, which was burning, which we all know is Pemex. Then we had a Latin America shorty loss. We had the plane crash in Spain, and we had an additional refinery fire, all of which were larger than the 10 million threshold, which on the corporate solution side separates the large losses from the not so large man-made losses. So it's the message is it's well spread. It's not one super large. It's more 5 or 6. Fairly large one above the threshold. And yeah, if you expect 4 on average, sometimes you see 5 or 6 and sometimes you see only 2 of them. And that explains the reason why sometimes we say we had a below average amount of large man-made losses and sometimes we have an above average amount.
Okay, thank you. Question comes from William Hawkins, KBW. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. First of all, back on the July renewals, I understand everything that you said, Matt, but at the end of the day, the business you're writing cannot be brand new business to the market. You must be taking it from somebody else. And so to the extent that you think it's attractive, can you tell us if it's 105% price adequacy, in your view, what would have been the expiring price adequacy from the point of view of the companies that are letting this business go? I mean, you must have some kind of view on that. And then back slightly to Michael's question about the Great Life results. Can you give us an indication? I think you were talking sort of 550 to 600 in absolute terms was your original profit ambition for this year. Where do you think we are by the first half? I mean, because obviously you benefited from capital gains and the rest of it. So, you know, would you just suggest we halve that or are you actually ahead of where you intended to be? And possibly asking the same question a different way, your 11% margin, operating margin in the second quarter, to what extent is that inflated by good luck or can we actually plug that in as a sustainable figure? Thanks.
Okay. I will not answer your first question, and the reason is it cannot really be answered. The reality is, since the growth comes from large and tailored transaction, most of this increase is actually one-off business and brand new business. A new need comes up somewhere. And this new need has to be or can be addressed by a new and unique solutions. Therefore, there is no expiring price, and that's the reason why I cannot answer your question.
May I just come back then and ask how much of the growth has come from broker place business versus directly sourced?
Let me quickly check. Give me a second. Can we answer the second question? And during this time, I will.
Yeah, that's fine.
So I'll give a shot at the question about life and health. So thanks for coming back. So what we said, as Michelle indicated, in the summer of 2013 is that we would like to achieve on a sustainable basis a return of equity between 10 and 12% on the then existing equity base, which was approximately $5.5 billion. The reason for referring to the then existing equity base was just to kind of take out a little bit the very significant ups and down impacts that rising or shrinking interest rates would have on the level of equity coming off the back of the unrealized gains. I think that's clear to everyone now. If you look at what we achieved in the second quarter, so a headline ROE of 14, but we've provided, similar to the way we did it in Q1, back out some of the things that perhaps are or good luck or other things. We have good luck and bad luck in every quarter, as you know. And we get to an underlying ROE for the quarter of about 11, just north of 11%. And I think for the first half, we're sitting at right at 11.4, 11.5%. So I think what I'm trying to say is that we're on track. Our businesses are always going to be characterized by individual quarters where you have a larger mortality on individual lives or not. But what I'd like to say is that on an underlying basis, off the back of the steps that we took during the period of 2013-2014, just to remind everyone, it was the capital structure, the leverage of the segment, dealing with the pre-2004 business, getting the right asset mix in place, and, of course, continue to write attractive new business. Those things, I think, will continue to support the profitability of the business going forward. As Michelle said, it's a little bit too early for us to talk about moving the target. Let's just hit the target. We're on track.
Sorry to come back, David, but the 11 to 11.5 that you just mentioned, is that on the original equity base of 5.5, or is that on the current equity base?
It's on the original equity base at 5.5, but you'll have seen with interest rate just moving up a little bit during Q2, the actual reported equity for the segment is only 5.7. But to be clear, it's on the 5.5.
Sorry, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Answering the second half of your first question, both channels contributed to the growth on the large transaction and tailored business side. The direct channel is a little bit stronger than the broker channel.
Thank you.
Next question comes from Andrew Ritchie, Autonomous. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Thanks. First question is for Matt again. I was looking at your business mix renewed and renewing year to date, and I see that casualty, which grew last year, is actually down slightly or flat in terms of proportion within your portfolio. I mean, is casualty still attractive? Is this just a function of the fact that some of the large deals you did happen to be in property stroke specialty areas? Maybe just comment on kind of where you see the casualty weighting from this point and whether it still seemed to be an attractive area for you. Second question, thanks for the additional presentation on the reserves this time round. I see you've suggested that you're in the 60th to 80th percentile of the best estimate range. As at the end of 2014, I mean, where did you sit at the end of 14 versus where you sat at the end of 13 within that range? I mean, is it stable? Are you up a little bit towards the upper end of it, or just any sort of qualitative indication would be useful? Thanks.
Thanks,
Andrew. Thank you for your question. It's a very good question. Casualty. Remember two or 3 years ago when we said now we will start again to grow casualty, we also said, and we will not grow it explosively. We will step gently on the accelerator. And that's exactly what we have been doing. Remember the split between large and structured transactions on the one side and transactional business on the other side. If I look at the transactional business, I see that we have continued to grow casualty moderately as we have been doing it in the past. However, if we look at the total premium distribution year to date for 2015, this casualty's moderate, gentle casualty growth is camouflaged by individual large transactions and tailored business, which are not on the casualty side. So you are kind of hinted and gave the answer to your question already correctly.
Is it still an attractively priced area? I mean, has it become? Obviously, a lot of your peers are trying to grow casualty as well.
Our view has unchanged on the casualty side. 50% of the volume comes from the US, for instance. And in the US, the underlying rate levels right now, they are approximately stable compared to rate levels pretty much everywhere else in the world, in all other geographies and segments where prices have been going down. So the relative attractiveness has been shifting from other lines and other segments towards casualty. And that is still true.
Okay, thanks. Mike? Andrew, this is Michael Eaves. Yeah, to answer your question on the range, we've stayed pretty much in the same level for the last couple of years. It varies quarter by quarter by when we look at it, but it's been fairly constant around the same level. And I think the other point I would add, despite the sort of strong reserve releases of the last periods, we are staying roughly the same strength. When we analyze the reserve each quarter, it's staying in roughly the same place, at least for the last few years.
And can I dare to ask, where are you within the 60 to 80? Should I just assume halfway, or?
We're in a good spot in the range. It's the best estimate.
Yeah. Okay, 79.9 then, right.
Okay. Thanks. I appreciate your sharp eye. I had to see that subtle move on the casualty side. I have to compliment your eye, Andrew. So thanks for that.
Thanks.
Next question comes from Andy Brookfield, Barclays. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon. Two questions I'd like to ask. One is just around admin re, and also in the context of the buyback. The tone seems to be more committed or certain around admin re. You talk about an 18-month timeline, actually, about closing some transactions, which I think is the first time, certainly that I recall, you being so certain about timings. And also around actually some... and Michelle, you mentioned about the priorities of investing as well. But in the context of the buybacks, and I apologize, this is sort of one long question, but in the context of the buybacks, it sounds to me like you would potentially not do a buyback if you felt there was a sufficiently large admin re-deal or other deal to do. And it sounds to me like there is or are potentially some significant admin re-transactions which are quite well developed, to be that they take some time to actually come to fruition. I don't know if I can get away with that being one question. If you give clarity on that. I'll ask the second one and you can either ignore it or not. The second question is just back to this growth to try and understand where it's coming from. If it's not coming from competitors per se, to try and understand what that new business is. Is this consolidating multiple lines for clients that you're doing, and therefore you can do it in size, and that's your advantage? Is it sort of solvency deals, therefore it is genuinely new business? Because I noticed, and I'm angling for a compliment like Andrew got last time, that actually you got a slight shift to US and a business away from Europe in those pie charts, which suggests it's not solvency II driven.
Okay, Andy, I take the first one. I suppose Matt will take the second one. You know, I will be massively boring with my answer to your first one, because if you were expecting a clear agenda of activities before, after share buyback or no share buyback, you will probably leave my answer a little bit frustrated. But I repeat the order that I said without coming into too much details. Definitely classical dividend, then opportunities, and then what used to be extra dividend, and then share buyback. The only thing that I can add to what I've said before, I won't invent an opportunity in the middle just for the pleasure of killing the share buyback option. So when we speak about option to invest our capital, a part of the one where Mother Nature is playing a role, it's definitely one corresponding to our appetite. But I'm sorry, don't expect from me that I give you more details about the 18 months and about what we are supposed to say at the end of quarter three or beginning of quarter four on the share buyback.
I guess just on that, in terms of timing, the share buyback commitment or otherwise or proposal was for the AGM next year. there's a timing difference between that and 18 months. So I'm just wondering if we could get to the end of this year and you could still be holding on just because there's still some potentially interesting transactions that still haven't come to fruition. Is that a possible scenario?
You know, Andy, there are lots of different scenarios. The authorization from our shareholder is valid until the next AGM, April 2016. So we have, I think, an opportunity to look at how the business is developing, the opportunities to invest that Michelle was describing. Just underlining the D, we're not going to invent opportunities to invest simply to have the pleasure of investing. It needs to meet our financial hurdles, as you've heard before. And we'll come to the conclusion later in the year as to whether or not it would make sense to go ahead and launch something on the share repurchase side. So, you know, our intent is to maintain a very strict capital management approach. We've outlined that to you before, and I don't think anything that we've said today should lead you to conclude that we're changing that.
Okay. With your follow-up question, you're definitely in the range of three questions now, but I will anyway answer it because if I didn't, somebody else will ask the question. So the spectrum of solutions that I describe with the label large and tailored transactions is extremely broad, and I would have to give you a very, very long answer to go into detail here, which I do not believe I should do. But it includes everything ranging from longevity swaps to some tailored multi-line transactions, external runoff transactions, or large property quota shares driven by a desire of an insurance client to cede more of their net cat exposure. So the range is very broad, also geographically.
Okay, thanks, and thanks for your patience with all three questions.
The next question comes from Xinwei Wang, Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my question. Xinwei Wang from Morgan Stanley. Just two questions, please. Firstly, just following up on the casualty lines. So your comment that rates are sort of okay in the US, but you're saying there are increases in specific areas. Would you be able to elaborate a bit on what sort of areas you're seeing increases, which lines, and what sort of magnitude, please? And then my second question is sort of on the theme of consolidation in the primary players, and particularly in the US, and some potentially some increased retentions there. I was wondering if you could comment on how you think CIS Re is best placed in this environment, please, and whether you think you know, if there could be any potential knock-on impact on pricing there. Thank you.
Okay, so I take the first question related to casualty. It is naturally, obviously, more geared towards the US than the rest of the world, just by the sheer size of the US market. Approximately 50% of the worldwide premium comes from the US. And typically the growth there comes from general liability and motor business, and a little bit of professional liability as well. It definitely does not come from pharmaceutical business. That's a line which we absolutely, really from the bottom of my heart and all our hearts, don't love at all. And it also does not come from the workers' compensation side. And I can give you also an order of magnitude by describing it as moderate growth.
Okay, thank you.
On your second question, maybe Michelle here. First,
as a player, we say it several times that in our activities there is one which is definitively based on potential acquisition. That's AdminRe. That's definitely the name of the game. We were never shy to say that also in the profitable growth story of corporate solution, we do not exclude analyzing opportunities. In reinsurance, definitively, we do believe and we are even convinced that we have quite an efficient platform. And I must say on the reinsurance side, I do see actually two type of activities, one a little bit more defensive and the other one, which is probably trying to, well, not trying, it's capital coming from outside the industry, probably inspired by a model which has been created 40 years ago by somebody based in Omaha. Now, what is the effect of mergers on the primary side on us? Well, it's something we are quite used to, and it simply underlined probably the interest of our regional and national diversification when we speak about client tierings. You know, we have clients which are the globals, something like 50 worldwide, so-called large clients, something like 200, and then 3,000-plus clients, which are called regional and nationals. And they are definitively probably a little bit more less volatile in their request of reinsurance than the top 250, and that's also one of the reasons why we expanded our activities successfully, by the way, in the last 2-3 years, and successfully especially in the U.S., and that's one of the reasons why you see this 30% increase in July. So, in a way, not a lot of surprise of what is happening on the primary market and its consequence on the reinsurance, and simply an enhanced interest to make our clients' portfolio as diversified as possible. But we've started that already a long time ago.
If I may just add two more brief comments before we go to the next question. The first is just that I hope you all realize that also whenever our clients get involved in significant transformations, whether it's related to the solvency regime they comply with or corporate developments, as we've seen now announced over the last half a year or so, typically that also presents opportunities for a company like Swiss Re. The companies will look at their portfolios. They'll think, are we optimally organized? Are there some concentrations we want to deal with, parts of our portfolio that may or may not be as attractive as we thought they were previously? So in and of itself, these types of large developments also open up opportunities for us. Even when companies indeed look at their overall purchasing approach, how they deal with the reinsurance market, I think it probably plays to our strength as we see some of this concentration going on. And the second thing, and I do this quite somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but Andy, let me just also compliment you for your sharp eye. You kind of passed over that one, but indeed exactly the same 1% change in the portfolio mix, so I guess the equal compliment is due.
Okay, thank you for your detailed answer.
Next question comes from Stefan Schumann, Bank of Togo. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Just a double question on renewals. Again, the first one, I saw that in April you had some late uptick in the volume. Can maybe just, I think, from 1.5 to 1.7 billion of volumes. Can just maybe indicate what it was or in terms of segment of geography? And the second one now, including all the renewals, can you give us an indication how much of the business now is proportional, how much non-proportional, and is?
Okay, so with respect to the first question, there are actually two reasons that explain this 200 million. The first is coming from FX changes. The US dollar is now stronger than it was 3 months ago. And the numbers have been restated using very recent FX rates. So that explains a part of the increase. And then we had a little bit of late renewal activity going on and late notification. However, it was actually not very big. It's just the April renewals volume-wise It's not a huge amount to begin with, so relatively small changes in absolute US dollars lead to larger changes in percent of the base. With respect to the business split, overall right now proportional business amounts to approximately 2/3 of the total volume. Facultative business is of the order of 10%, and the rest somewhere in the high 20s, that is non-proportional reinsurance business.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Next question comes from James Shuck, UBS. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Two questions from me, please. I wondered, could you just comment a little bit about the outlook for longevity risk? Obviously, with Solvency II sort of working its way through the system, presumably we're going to see more and more supply of longevity risk, and I'm just wondering what your appetite is for that and where you see pricing, how you actually assess profitability on it as well might be helpful. And then secondly, on the admin re side, I also picked up the fact that, you know, you seem to have more confidence in the pipeline, and, you know, rather than necessarily linking this with the dividend, I just wanted to understand kind of what's driving that, because you talk about the 18-month period. I mean, it seems a sort of Russian standoff at the moment, particularly in the UK market, because lots of closed books and no one's actually doing anything yet, and it seems as if it's going to take one player to make a move, and then all of a sudden, you know, the dominoes start toppling and then lots of things start happening. So could you just sort of comment on how you see that market and, you know, whether my interpretation is the right way of thinking about it, or whether it kind of your 18-month confidence is completely separate to that?
Okay. Shall I take the longevity question? So we do have some appetite for longevity risk at the right price. And the reason why I have the wish to emphasize at the right price is the following. Once you write longevity risk, by definition, it stays on your book for a relatively long amount of time. And while we have a very big balance sheet, we can write only so much. So we look at it as capacity, different to net cat capacity, which we can renew on an annual basis. That's not to the same extent possible on the longevity side. And the good thing is we do have capacity, which means we do have appetite for it, but knowing that once we write it, it stays on our book for a while, we have minimum price standards in force, and business that is below these standards will not be written by Swiss Re. In the long term, I believe longevity risk will become bigger and bigger, and since eventually it will become a really, really big problem, not just for society, but also for the pension funds and insurance and reinsurance companies. And that's the reason why I personally believe that in the very long run, price levels will probably rather increase than decrease.
Thanks, Matt. If I may, I know some of you will recognize you've been hearing that from us now for a couple of years. So just to underline, indeed, Solvency II will be upon us shortly. That no doubt will have some impact on clients under that regime and similar types of regimes that are coming into force elsewhere. But this idea of we anticipate quite a significant demand for that capacity coming at us over the course of the next decades, perhaps, I think is once again underlining our longer-term approach and our discipline in terms of how we apply our capacity. So just to underline, that's a message you've heard from us before, but we are open for business on the longevity side. The admin re-pipeline.
So there's nothing concrete about 18 months. You know that the gestation period of these transactions can be a little bit longer than some of the other business that we ride across the Swiss Re group. But if you just look at the level of the changes that have taken place in the UK over the course of the last 12 months, both from a regulatory point of view, but also from a tax point of view and other changes in the pension environment, you can imagine that we've had quite significant and even intense dialogues with many players, clients in the UK market over the last period of time. And we feel as though we're now getting to the point where some of those clients are ready to make decisions, and we feel that we're extremely well-placed in order to be an active consolidator in that marketplace. Now, we haven't been standing still over the last couple of years. You know, we've been investing in our platform, improving its operational capability, but also its scalability. So we remain confident that we are a buyer of choice. I think we maintain very solid relationships with both the sellers, the clients here, as well as with the regulatory environment. And we continue to demonstrate every day that we're treating our customers, the policyholders, fairly. So we remain confident that we're well positioned for what we anticipate to be significant change over the next 18 months.
Okay, thank you very much.
The next question comes from Vinit Malhotra, Mediobanca. Please go ahead.
Oh, hello there. Good afternoon, Vinit here from Mediobanca. Actually, I did want to ask for a buyback, but maybe I'll let it go for now. But on the reserve release, on the spring presentation, in the end, there is this comment that we could, if claims remain benign, we could expect reserve releases to come in at levels lower than previous years. Is it some kind of a message that we should start expecting some kind of a normalized levels of runoff in your guidance? So that's the first question. Second thing is a bit more minutiae question. The realized gain, the P&C has an interest rate derivative gain in the second quarter. And I'm a bit curious that the 157 million or so gain that has been shown in a quarter when interest rates are not going down really. So what kind of structure is this? If you could just comment quickly, it will be useful. And on the buyback, I was only curious, and I appreciate AdminRe, but over the last 2 years, the AdminRe has been geared to, you know, there are so many initiatives to get third-party capital and et cetera. So just the magnitude that it would actually impact your buyback decision is a bit of a surprise. It's just a comment. Thanks.
Okay, Vinet, this is Michael Eaves. I'll take your first question. I think on reserve releases, we've seen a lot of reserve releases over the last few years, primarily because claims have been lower than expected. And the actuarial methodology that I tried to explain on the video sort of takes a time where you get from your originally price loss ratio down to actually what your experience loss ratio is. So that's given the gradual release of these reserves. I think prices have come down over the last few years, so the expectation is that if there remains any margin, that's going to be much lower than in the past. So I think just logically thinking about how things operate, yes, I mean, the expectation is that if there are reserve releases, these are going to come down because prices have adjusted over the last few years. And I think the other thing I'd mention, you know, if actual experience turns out exactly as we expected as all these portfolios run off, there really will be no reserve releases or whatever. So whilst we're confident with the level of our reserves and confident with our pricing, yes, if the current claims trends continue, particularly with inflation and other factors that affect the amount of claims we pay, then I think that statement's a very valid one. We are exposed on the reserves to changes in trends, particularly inflation, which does increase the claim values and affects the reserve releases. It also affects the interest rate side of our balance sheet as well, by the way. We only look totally at reserves. But if current claims continues, then, you know, we don't see a change in that sort of trend. We don't see ourselves, as at least in the short term, moving to an adverse development position. So,
Thank you.
Okay, let me pick up the other two parts of your question, Vinet. First on the gains. So part of the gains, of course, are coming not from the fixed income side, but from the equity side. If you look at the way the interest rates moved over the course of the quarter, you also see there's some ups and downs in terms of interest rates. But indeed, at the end of the day, we also benefited from some bond positions that we had sold short. So as interest rates rose, we actually were able to pick up some gains on those positions. Coming back to your third question around M&RE, so I don't know if I can add a whole lot to what I just said. Listen, we remain committed to this market. It's core to our overall strategy. We remain open to potentially involving third-party capital. As you know, right now we have bank financing. I think we've earlier indicated we're preparing for a potential capital markets debt issuance sometime in the not too distant future. And as and when we would indeed be successful in concluding large transactions, there's a possibility that we as yet would bring in third-party capital. So the messaging around that has not changed.
All right. Thanks, Eric. Thank you very much.
Next question.
We have a follow-up question from Mr. Michael Huttner. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My lucky day. So, just two questions. One is these large deals. I forgot the name. They're not large structured. They're something else. But the are they multi-year or will they fall off next year and then we'll have minus 30%? I'm exaggerating. And then the second question is on the potential deal appetite. Is the right number to think about when we think about this the amount in the other column in your balance sheet, which net of $2.6 billion of principal is about $4.8 billion? Thank you.
Okay, I'll do the first question. We call it large and tailored transactions. And some of them are single year and some of them are multi-year. We have both.
Okay.
And let me pick up the second. So I like your math. So we have at the group what we refer to as free capital, part of which, of course, is indeed invested in our principal investments portfolio, so not as liquid. The rest of it is relatively liquid and really accessible to us. We maintain that for several different purposes. Including a little bit of reserve for future dividends, as well as potential investment in our various business units.
And the figure is 4.8.
That number, at least, is roughly correct. The number I show is 4.7, so you're in the ballpark.
4.7. Okay, now it's fine. Thank you.
Okay, can we have the next question, please?
Yes, as a reminder, then if you wish to register for a question, please press star and one on your telephone. The next question is a follow-up question from Mr. Andy Brookfield. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Sorry to pepper you so many today. There was a comment in the detailed P&C breakdown on the reserve, adverse reserve development on the motor in UK and France. I was wondering whether you can just give us a little bit of colour on the what's driving that. Is it one-off? Is it catching up on a trendy side of the sea? That would be helpful. The second question is on longevity, just your comments around longevity. Longevity, because of the nature of it, the sort of cumulative aggregate exposure, every time you write a bit of business, you're adding new exposure. How do you think about those limits in the context of the group? And how are you planning to manage not to get too carried away, given that by your own expectations, pricing should only really be moving upwards on this particular risk?
Okay, Andy, I'll take the first question. I think I didn't quite hear you properly, but I think you're referring to the PPOs and probably our comment on slide 13 saying reserves for UK motor increased during 2014. Yeah, I mean, as you're aware, in the UK in recent years, we've seen more motor liability claims being paid as annuities rather than lump sums. And that has quite an impact on Swiss Re, at least from a US GAAP reporting point of view. If we pay a lump sum, that's basically the present value of future payments, and it gets paid out today, and it goes off our balance sheet. When it's an annuity, it's obviously a series of payments that we project into the future. There's an inflation assumption in there. It's the same as a lump sum, but it just doesn't get discounted back. And since we're under US GAAP, we don't discount. This has quite an impact on the actual cash amounts that we're going to pay, because effectively we're not allowing for the interest in future. So one thing we've been tracking for a few years is just what sort of proportion of claims are being paid as annuities and how much is being paid as lump sum. That very much varies according to size of the claim. So the smaller amounts tend to still be paid as lump sums, but the larger amounts going into, say, a few million, there's an increased propensity to pay as annuities. So our analysis in 2014 came to the conclusion that there were slightly more annuities than we previously assumed, so we pushed up that propensity. That's what that assumption means, and therefore that had an impact on the reserves, because we assume more annuity payments rather than lump sums.
Okay, so not really an economic...
But on an economic basis, they balance out, basically.
Okay. With respect to your question on longevity and how big is our appetite in terms of exposure, we actually look at two exposure measures. One is the shortfall, and if I gave you the shortfall number, it actually wouldn't help you at all, because you would need to know the model behind the model that calculates the shortfall, and without knowing that, you could not develop a feeling for what this means. And that's the reason why we also look at the present value of future claims on the longevity side. And we do this on the longevity side as well as on the mortality side, recognizing that there is some degree of potential offsetting that might be possible between mortality and longevity. It's not a complete hedge, but there is some anti-correlation going on. And at the current price level, we say we want the present value of future claims on the longevity side to be significantly smaller than on the mortality side, on the traditional life side. And that makes sure that we don't get carried away with respect to the exposure we are assuming. Please be assured that we have a very well-defined exposure measure framework in place and limits as well, and referrals and governance around this.
Okay, thank you. It seems that we've come to the end of our Q&A. So you can obviously join any member of the investor relations team if you have follow-up questions. With that, I'd like to thank you again for your participation today.